This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Few exhibition games of any sport are remembered 40 years later. But the 1973 tennis match between self-proclaimed male chauvinist Bobby Riggs and women's tennis trailblazer Billie Jean King so captivated the nation that it's the most well-known event in the lives of either player, though both had distinguished careers on the court. King won 20 Wimbledon titles and led an uprising of women players demanding fairer treatment and compensation. She's the subject of an American Masters documentary that aired earlier this month, which you can find online at the American Masters website. At 69, Billie Jean King remains active in the game as a recreational player and as an owner in World Team Tennis. She spoke Thursday to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Billie Jean King, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you. Well, this is the 40th anniversary of your match, the Battle of the Sexes, your match with Bobby Riggs. I want to listen to some of the pre-match build-up here. And what we're going to hear here is a slightly edited montage from the American Masters documentary. And we're going to hear you and Bobby Riggs talking to some reporters. And then at the end of it, we'll hear Bobby Riggs with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Let's listen.
I think a lot's at stake for women's lib.
I like the idea that I'm playing for someone else besides myself.
I got 120,000 letters from Bobby's mob. This is the mob of guys all over the world who wrote and told me they were rooting for me. I wouldn't let these guys down for the world.
This is the atmosphere of a prize fight.
It is. That's exactly what it is.
She's carrying a banner for the women's lib. I'm carrying male is supreme, the male is king, no matter what the difference in age.
This is a bunch of baloney. First of all, people are people, and some are more supreme than others in different things.
Do you like women?
I like them real good in the bedroom, the kitchen, and I really think...
You're a male chauvinist, eh?
And that is our guest, Billie Jean King, 40 years ago with Bobby Riggs before the famed tennis Battle of the Sexes in 1973. That was from the American Masters documentary, by the way, which aired Tuesday. You can still get it online at the American Masters website. You obviously had a lot of joint appearances together with Bobby Riggs, building up the attention for the match. Did you feel like you got to know him at all?
Well, actually, Bobby was one of my heroes. I knew all the champions in our sport preceding me. I knew that the Second World War had actually hurt his career, which I felt bad for him because it didn't allow him to get the recognition he deserved. He was finally at least getting recognition. I don't know. I don't think most people realized what a great champion he had been, even though I would tell them. I don't think they were really tuned in to that at the time.
Well, yeah, he was 55 when he was doing this thing.
He was as old as my father. And I told him, I mean, for me to beat him meant absolutely nothing athletically. Okay, nothing. But it's what it represented. Here's a hero of mine. He's going on and on about women in the bedroom and keeping pregnant and barefooted and all these things. And I'm like, oh, my God, he was funny. But, I like Showtime. I love entertainment. And I think being a tennis player, you're a performer.
Right.
So I got that part. And I thought, you know what, Bobby, just go for it. But I'm going to tell you, I'm not letting you get under my skin. It did tee us up, though. I must say it teed us up. The women's movement, Title IX the year before, all the things that I've been fighting for forever, equal opportunities for boys and girls. You know, it's funny because everybody talks about how this divided us. Actually, it brought everybody together. It did exactly what I wanted. It had all these parties, all these bets from people. Everybody was crazy at this time about this match.
Well, what I wanted to ask you was, do you think Bobby Riggs really held these strong beliefs about the role of women, or was this just basically shtick that he developed to get attention?
I think he was chauvinistic. I think he probably went over the top for the match, but... He's a very kind person, but I think he's very chauvinistic.
All right.
But a really nice chauvinist. And he and I remained friends up until the day he died from prostate cancer.
1994, I think, right? Yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think it was 94.
So the day the match arrives and Riggs enters accompanied by a bunch of young women, you enter like Cleopatra carried on a train of muscular guys. This is obviously part of the show. Yeah, you felt okay about that?
Oh, yeah, I felt great because... it's Showtime, and Jerry Parenteau was quite sweet behind, before I came out. He said, I have this Egyptian litter. Do you think you'd get in? I know you're a feminist. You probably won't. I said, are you kidding? It's showtime. This is perfect. Absolutely, I'll get up here. Let's have some fun. You know, the crowd deserves a good show. Obviously, I was about ready to die because I've got to win this match. I mean, the reality of it. But I also, you know, your fans always come first.
Were you nervous when it was time to start?
Actually, what happens to me is I get really nervous the farther out I am. I'm really nervous. And then I start getting into this place in my head, which I do not know how I get there. You know, people say, well, how do you get there? I start just trying to feel and visualize the moment, how it's going to be and how am I going to respond. But you don't really know how it's going to be, especially this one-shot deal. The one thing I did do to prepare is I went to the Astrodome and I looked at the top of the building. It's huge. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of feet up it is. I also wanted to make sure I knew the lay of the land, understand how to get around the arena, because nothing's worse than going to a new place and not finding your way, and you have to keep trying to talk to the guards. I met all the guards. I knew where all the elevators were. I knew where my locker room was. I knew where the car would come and let us off or where it'd pick us up at the end. I mean, I go through all these logistics because they're just as important if you're not used to an arena, so you don't get lost or get out of sorts. You don't want to get out of sorts for those kinds of reasons. That's the last thing you want on your head. So I was very picky on that. I'm very much a perfectionist because you have to remember the depth perception was going to be totally different than any tennis court I played on. If you look at when you watch, if everybody just look at the backgrounds where people are sitting and then watch what a real tournament looks like where they have this blue tarp up where it's beautiful. You can see the ball and all that. We had none of that. Look how the lines people are dressed. They're just people that used to play it, you know, they played at clubs and just asked them to be a lines person. We had no security. Can you imagine?
Does it bother you that, you know, 40 years later, that when people hear Billie Jean King's name, they may not remember that you won 20 Wimbledon titles, but they remember the Bobby Riggs match?
I knew that was going to happen actually at the time because you could tell it was going to get the most exposure I was ever going to get in my life. And so I knew that would happen. Every day I leave the apartment in New York City where I live, I know someone's probably going to bring up that match. And every day, if I'm out in public since that match in 1970, I at least get one or more people coming up to me, talking to me about it. Most people, if they're old enough to have seen it, remember exactly where they were that day. And they tell me their story. And it's very fascinating.
I confess I do. I remember where I was.
See, where were you?
I was in college, and I missed the match because I was at a political meeting that night, believe it or not.
Well, that's good. At least you were an activist.
You know, the other thing that happens in this period is, you know, your discovery of, well, you're dealing with your sexual orientation. You were married to Larry King very young, your then husband. When did you realize you were gay?
I was trying to figure out what I was. I didn't know if I was bisexual, gay, whatever. I had asked Larry for a divorce, and he wouldn't give me a divorce. And I didn't talk to him about my feelings, though. Then, and I really, that's how fearful and homophobic I was. So I was paralyzed. I guess that's the best word I can use. I was paralyzed. And I was just trying to figure things out. And I was starting to get worried about, I'd had this affair with Marilyn Barnett, and I was starting to worry about it. She had been my assistant. So it was a difficult time for me, and I didn't know what to do, really. It was very different back in the 70s than it is now. It was very different when I was outed in 81. It just wasn't the same as it is now.
You mentioned that you were outed in 1981 when the woman that you had this relationship, Marilyn Barnett, I guess sought
money, honey.
Yeah,
it's about
right.
money. What else?
There was
new?
A dispute over property and money.
It was just ridiculous.
Right. And so I don't know, this came out in a way that was not of your choosing. And you were a public figure, a very public figure at the time. And I'm wondering kind of what you ended up holding a news conference to kind of air it out and answer questions. And I'm wondering what kind of advice you got and why you decided to do what you did.
I got the opposite advice. My lawyer, Dennis Wasser, and my publicist, Pat Kingsley, absolutely did not want me to do this. And I said, I have to do it. So we're up about 48 hours off and on arguing and discussing. And finally, I got them to understand that I had to do this, no matter what the consequence, that I had to tell the truth. And therefore, they said, okay. And we suffered through this. It was very difficult. Larry was there, and then Larry and I started discussing life, and Larry still didn't want to get a divorce. I had all these different things going on. Of course, my poor mom and dad didn't know what hit him. Peck Kingsley had to call them to get him there quickly.
Yeah, how did they react to the idea of appearing in public with you then? I mean, they were at the news conference.
Well, you know what? My parents, they showed up, and I'll always appreciate the fact they showed up. They were not happy. My mother was crying. My dad, we were all suffering. But my parents showed up. They didn't stay home. And I'll always appreciate the fact they got there. And I knew how hard it was for them, being so homophobic. I knew that that was the worst thing. You know, my parents never would watch my brother and me play that much in sports. They never were in the limelight. They didn't live through us. They had their own lives, very much in love. I just remember looking at them, feeling so bad for them. I felt so bad for Larry and just everybody in my life at the time. It was just a horrible, horrible feeling.
And you said, you know, you felt like you needed to do this for yourself to kind of, I guess, publicly.
I needed to do the, you know.
And were you right in the end when it had happened?
It really got down to what my parents had actually taught me about our values. Thinking back and thinking, well, I had to do it. Why, you know, why? And it's very simple, actually. My mom and dad always taught us to thine own self be true, have peace of mind, just do the right thing, even if it's not popular. And this is one of these times. This is not going to help me be popular. If anything, it could ruin my whole career and life because I was just getting ready to retire. And I started to have long-term sponsorship deals for the first time, like lifetime deals. You know, in sports, that's huge when you get older. And we didn't make the big bucks. So I was really going to be able to cash in a way, for me. Just for me, to get to finally make some really good money.
Sports apparel, that kind of thing.
Apparels, you know, the racket deal. I had some other things pending.
And then
I lost them all overnight, and I had to start over, basically. And
it hurt you financially.
Just basically start over. And then Larry and I finally got divorced. So that's another, you know, 50% of your net worth goes bye-bye. But that's fine. You know, you just have to keep going. It wasn't fine at the time, but yeah. You know, and my partner Ilana Kloss, you know, we've been together for years and years. So it was hard. It was terrible for her. You know, that I really felt the most sorry as time went on for Ilana because what she had to deal with. And we've been together 34 years, so we've been together a long time. And Ilana has been through hell with all of this. So I really owe her a lot there. And
Our time is short here. I wanted to talk a little bit more about tennis. I mean, what do you think of the game today, about the way women are treated, about the way it's played?
I wish I could hit like they do, that's for sure. I think it's fantastic what's available to the women and to the men. The men still have more opportunities, but the majors are equal prize money, which I think is wonderful. That took this is actually the 40th year of equal prize money at the U.S. Open. And they were the first. And it took us it took us 34 more years until 2007 to have all four majors equal prize money. But the tennis today, I'm a big believer in every generation gets better. I think Serena Williams is the greatest, will be, if she continues on the road that she's on now, it's being the greatest player ever to have lived in women's tennis. Her serve is absolutely beautiful. Pancho Gonzalez and Pete Sampras and Serena Williams, those three people have the best technique on their serves in the history of the sport. I think every child should watch all of their serves if they want to, you know, aspire to be a terrific player. And the men's tennis is doing better than ever because of the four guys, Federer, Nadal, Murray, Djokovic. Those four guys are just simply a cut above the rest.
Well, I guess we're out of time. Billie Jean King, it's been great. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Billie Jean King speaking with Dave Davies last Thursday. King is the subject of a just-aired American Masters documentary. You can find a link to it online at our website, freshair.npr.org. People who don't believe in God but do have an almost religious belief in causes are at the center of the new novel Dissident Gardens by our next guest, Jonathan Lethem. He spoke with Terry Gross last Monday. The novel is about three generations of one family and opens in 1955 in Queens when Rose Zimmer, a secular Jew and a communist, is expelled from the party, ostensibly because the local committee disapproves of her affair with a black police officer. Rose is a single mother who brings up her daughter Miriam to believe it's just a matter of time until the Nazis or the FBI come knocking. Miriam flees Queens and her perpetually dissatisfied mother by moving to Greenwich Village, where in 1961 she marries a folk singer. They're activists in the peace movement and live in a commune where they raise their son Sergius, who describes his birthright as half-Jewish, full hippie. The characters of Rose and Miriam were inspired by Lethem's grandmother and mother, and Sergius's story connects to parts of Lethem's own life. Jonathan Lethem won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his 1999 novel Motherless Brooklyn. His 2003 novel, The Fortress of Solitude, was a bestseller.
Jonathan Lethem, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the new book. Why did you want to write about three generations of a family where radical political convictions and utopian ideology create more conflict within their own circles than these convictions accomplish in terms of social change?
Wow. I think that I couldn't possibly have started by wanting to do that. What I wanted to do was write about my grandmother's sex life. But
So I hit the nail on the head, didn't I?
but I did. I think I did end up doing what you just said. I mean, I hope so. It sounds really great. And the thing is, you know, you don't end up where you began with a giant book. I knew that I had a kind of a legacy. I grew up in a family of protesters, and that I'd never really gone there. And I wanted to touch it. I wanted to think about it. I also wanted to think about just, I don't know, somehow I was ready to think about my grandmother's weird, lonely, imperial existence in Sunnyside, Queens.
Well, we must get right to your grandmother's sex life. Why were you interested in exploring her sex life? That's not something people usually say about their grandmothers, that that's what they're interested in.
You know, I felt that she was in love with Abraham Lincoln and in love with...
She didn't have sex with him, I'm sure.
Fiorello LaGuardia.
Nor him.
And she couldn't get into bed with either of these guys. But I also felt she was in love with a local beat cop, that he was more than a figure of, you know, kind of public order and decency, but there was something too sexy about her admiration. And this made sense to me. She was a woman who was mostly single, even if she did have affairs. And I think she did have affairs. I don't know who they were with. But I felt all of the things that she avowed most as kind of noble and heroic were, first of all, had a sexy quality to them, to her, that she would never have acknowledged. And the other thing was they were kind of authority figures. So this person who was a socialist was also really into presidents, cops, and mayors, and judges, and even priests, because she would sometimes talk about the, you know, if there was like a local Irish Catholic priest in Queens who was doing a lot of good for the local boys, she would be over-involved in her admiration. And I thought, this is where this person is really complicated. She loves a man in uniform.
The grandmother in your novel, Rose, is a communist who's kind of kicked out of the party. But what defines her more than her politics is really her paranoia and all of her fears. And part of those fears are because of the Holocaust. And you write that for Rose, God existed just on the puny extent he could disappoint her by his non-existence. Her anger at him was immense, almost godlike. So I'm just wondering how you think the Holocaust affected your grandmother and her relationship with God or her perception of a lack of God's presence.
Yeah. I mean, what a tormenting situation to be an intellectual woman of her generation and grow up with this enormous identity, but it was an identity founded on belief that she couldn't sustain. She was violently secular. She loved culture and she loved books, and all sorts of things that Jews care for, but she couldn't believe in the Jewish God or any God. And it, you know, she felt terrible about it, and she felt enraged that other people didn't see the obviousness of it all at once. But she'd substituted, I think, at some point, other kinds of beliefs. Belief in a kind of, I guess the best word is humanism. And I think if she was at any point seriously a communist, and I think probably she was somewhere in there, maybe not till 1956, that was a belief. And as anybody who studied the history of communist movements knows, it has a religious, you know, it's analogous. It draws passion out of people and sometimes irrational passion. And yeah, she was paranoid, and she took the Holocaust very personally, and yet it didn't belong to her the way it belonged to some other people, because she was also conflicted at best about her Jewish identity.
Rose is a very gives off a very negative energy, the grandmother in the book. And as one character says of her, she was all about power, the power of resentment, of guilt, of unwritten injunctions against everything, against life itself. Rose was into death. And I'm wondering if you felt that from your grandmother and how it affected you to be around such negative energy.
Well, I think she was different ways at different times. And, in my life, which isn't what I've written about directly here, there's a before and after in my experience of my grandmother, and it's a tragic one. She lost her daughter, my mother. You know, my mother died when she was 36. I was 14. She lost her only child. So there's my grandmother while my mother was still alive and healthy, and there's my grandmother after she begins to see that my mother's cancer is going to kill her. And she was a very dark person. She was betrayed. The world had betrayed her utterly. But I also think that I was very interested in the book in writing about the perplexities of seeing someone who was so into so many kinds of theoretical freedom. She embraced such diversity. That's a very bland word. But she really, you know, diversity was like heroic to her. And that was a passion that mattered to me. But at the same time, there was a kind of control freak, a kind of intolerance of, I guess, what I would say was much more typical of my mother and of the life of my family as I knew it, apart from my grandmother, a kind of polymorphous, you know, countercultural freedom on the ground, freedom to mess up, freedom to be, you know, my grandmother, for instance, was always taking me on the rare chances she could pry me away completely. She would rush me to a barber for a haircut. Somehow seemed like that was, you know, whatever kind of freedom she was into, she was not into the 8-year-old boy having long hair that made him look like a girl. And so these, you know, the different ways you can be free in your mind and free in your heart, I guess for me, Rose is an emblem of the contradictions.
So we've been talking about the grandmother, Rose. Her daughter, Miriam, who is the bohemian, ends up living in something of a commune. And I'd like you to read a short passage from the book. And this is actually a letter that she's written to her father, who lives in East Germany, who is separated from her mother. A long story. I don't think we'll get into that part of the story. But so here she is trying to explain her living situation to her father, who she really doesn't know well because he left when she was 3. And during this reading, you're going to mention the name of Tommy. Tommy is Miriam's husband, and he's a folk singer.
We live in a commune, something I suspect you wouldn't really be familiar with. Honestly, Tommy and I are like the parents, and they're like the children, so it isn't really a legitimate commune, not like the Maoist one around the corner on Avenue C, which has meetings nearly every night, and they go on for hours, and they never figure anything out. Ours is somewhere between a commune and a hostel. We started by letting Stella move in upstairs. Then we had to fill more rooms to afford to keep this place because Tommy hasn't made any money from his records in a long time, and the money from the ACLU settlement for my wrongful arrest on public property is a distant memory. Did I ever mention I was one of the Capital Steps 13? We sued their asses. Then I spent the money mostly at Pathmark on bread and veggies and ground beef. By this time in the morning, the phone has started ringing, and usually someone has rolled a joint, and things are getting a little harder to put down in order. I mean, after the kid is off to school. I spend a lot of time listening, actually. You might not think so from this letter, which is all about me, but I do. The phone rings, or someone comes downstairs, and the kitchen is pretty much full of people for the rest of the day.
That's Jonathan Lethem reading from his new novel, Dissident Gardens. How close is that to the home that you grew up in?
Well, at times, very close. I mean, my parents did essentially turn our home into a commune. In retrospect, it seems clear to me. Although, ironically, in the way kids make distinctions, I was always very particular about it. I knew what the communes were. They were the collective households that were all over our neighborhood, because there were a whole bunch of them, where there was no family at the center of it. You know, they had a kind of a flat egalitarian rule. Everyone was an equal and everyone was chipping it for the rent. And my parents, you know, they really were running the show. They were, in the end, they were collecting rent from people who in another context might have been called, you know, boarders. But we shared dish nights and we shared cooking nights and we had these consternating house meetings where grown human adults would air out their grievances to eight-year-old children as if we were all equally entitled to suffer one another's complaints. And, you know, I kind of loved it. I write about it in the book fairly affectionately, but it was, you know, certainly confusing for me in certain ways.
Something else that you were exposed to in ways that you probably didn't necessarily know at the time, you write that your parents had an open marriage and that you later learned that some of their friends were actually their lovers. And one of the characters in your book says, is anything more unforgivable than what a child learns about his parents from their lovers? Were you ever in that position?
Well, yeah. I mean, and this isn't directly part of this book or my other, you know, kind of autobiographical, emotional slag heap, The Fortress of Solitude. But I learned the fact that my mother was dying, not that she was sick, not that she was very sick, but that she was absolutely going to die, not from either one of my parents, but from my father's girlfriend at the time. Probably my father thought I knew and understood already. But I, as I've just said, children are literal. I kept it in a box. If she was sick, she was sick. That's different from dying or dead. But the first time it was told to me clearly so that I couldn't evade it or mistake it for some other information, it was my father's girlfriend. And
did she know that you didn't know?
I don't think she went into that situation thinking she was making a big move. I think she just said it. And maybe by the end of the encounter, she grasped that she'd ended up telling me. Not a good moment for anyone involved. And yeah, I mean, there, you know, if I want to feel angry, I still know that person and am affectionate. I feel affectionately toward them. But if I want to feel angry, I could remember that moment and I'd probably be able to get angry for the rest of my life.
Having grown up with two generations of people who believed in causes and were committed to causes, communism in your grandmother's life and, you know, like the anti-war movement, did you have any, like, commitment to political causes, or did you separate from the world of causes and head more in another direction?
I don't know. I'm pretty incoherent, and I think about I walk around believing that I have strong, coherent positions and that they're strongly reflected in my behavior and my choices and my speech much more than I suspect is really the case. And sometimes I make these halting gestures, and they mean a lot to me when I make them, you know, and I'll pick a cause and I'll be doing what I can for it in this, you know, muddle that we call life. And then I think I sometimes also probably wander away a lot. So I'm, you know, I'm nothing clear at all.
Which is in opposition to the certitude that your family had.
Yeah. I mean, but the belief that you're making a kind of systematic and coherent political life is much easier to sustain, even for my parents and their generation. And I don't mean that critically. And as well for my grandmother, you know, who on close inspection was, you know, incoherent as well, even if she had a lot more of a sensation of righteousness than I can get away with.
Jonathan Lethem, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Such a good time for me. Thank you, Terry.
Jonathan Lethem speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Lethem's new novel is Dissident Gardens. Our next guest, Barton Gellman, has reported on classified intelligence documents given to him by Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor. After leaking classified documents to several journalists, Snowden is now living in Russia, where he's been granted temporary asylum. Gelman is a reporter for The Washington Post and spoke with Terry last Wednesday. As a result of the Snowden leaks, Gelman and fellow journalist Laura Poitras broke the story of the PRISM program, which mines data from 9 U.S. internet companies, including Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and Facebook. Gelman reported that the NSA has broken privacy rules or overstepped its legal authority thousands of times each year since Congress expanded the agency's powers in 2008. Gelman also reported on the black budget, which he received from Snowden, the secret budget funding classified programs in America's 16 spy agencies. Barton Gelman has won 2 Pulitzers and wrote the bestseller Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency. Gelman also is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation.
Bart Gelman, welcome back to Fresh Air. Did Edward Snowden share your concerns about protecting national security, or would he have preferred that you just publish everything and make all these secrets public?
Well, I'll tell you what he said, and I'll tell you what he did. He gave these documents ultimately only to 3 journalists. What he said he wanted was for us to use our own judgment and to make sure that his bias was kept out of it so that we would make our own judgment about what was newsworthy and important for the public to know. And he said we should also consider how to avoid harm. Now, in case anyone doubts his intentions, let's consider what he could have done. If Chelsea Manning was able to exfiltrate and send to WikiLeaks and publish in whole 500,000 U.S. government documents, Edward Snowden, who is far, far more capable, had far greater access, certainly knows how to transmit documents. He could have sent them to WikiLeaks. He could have set up and mirrored around the internet in a way that could not be taken down all of the documents. They could all be public right now, and they're not, because that's not what he wanted to do. He told us not to do it, and he didn't do it himself.
Did you at any point feel compelled to talk to Snowden about what journalistic standards are for making government secrets public?
Oh, yeah, we had those conversations. The world of journalism was foreign to him. He had been essentially a spy all of his professional life. He was not accustomed to talking to journalists. He didn't understand all the rules under which we operated. And once he released the documents to us, his greatest fear was that he would be caught and that the documents would not be published, that we would somehow be restrained or we would lose our access to them. And he would have taken all these risks for nothing without achieving the larger public debate he was looking for. And so he was impatient for the stories to begin. And I told him what I tell every source, that we can only publish when we're ready. We have to authenticate this stuff. It looks quite valid to us, but we have to know for sure that these documents are real. We have to consider the security harms. We have to consider the newsworthiness. We have to set them in context. We're going to consult with the government and, you know, hold your horses. And he understood that. There were times when he didn't like it, but he understood it.
Was he worried that when you approached the government to tell them some of the things you were going to publish to get their reaction and see what their concerns were, that that would out him? And that he would be at risk, that they'd figure out it was him?
He was not so much concerned that we would out him. In fact, he's unique among sources I've known over the years, and he's also unique among people who want to blow the whistle, in that he intended all along and actually did unmask himself quite quickly. He did not want to be caught and preempted. But once the information began to flow, and once he came to believe that it would be very difficult for the government to stop that, he wanted to come out, tell the public who he was and why he was doing what he was doing. I mean, even Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers in the 1970s, did not do that. He did not voluntarily unmask himself. He was caught, and then he openly professed his beliefs and his reasons for doing so, and he didn't try to deny it, but he also didn't initiate the self-disclosure.
He told you that the U.S. intelligence community, quote, will most certainly kill you if they think you're the single point of failure that could stop this disclosure. So were you ever concerned that you were going to be assassinated because you were publishing this?
Honestly, I did not think that likely. He was also concerned that he could be. And if you look at it logically, he has this great big pile of some of the most sensitive secrets in the U.S. government and in the intelligence community. He thought if the only way that the government could stop that, if the government had a plausible chance of preempting the release of these things by tracking him down and killing him, that it would do so. I don't know that to be true. I am, frankly, a little bit skeptical. I don't think that that's ordinarily the way the U.S. government operates. But I certainly wasn't qualified to say for sure. And frankly, there are a number of things that have been disclosed in the documents, either publicly or that I have seen myself, that surprised me, that I would have said a year ago, having spent all this time covering post-9/11 national security establishment, I would have said, nah, the government wouldn't do that. And it does. It doesn't rise anywhere near the level of going out and committing a sort of an assassination to preempt disclosure. But he pointed out, in fact, look, you know, the U.S. government does now openly target Americans overseas for killing. And I guess I couldn't rule it out.
For yourself or for him?
For him. I never thought that I was at personal risk.
Mm-hmm. You asked him, you've written this, that you asked him how he could justify exposing espionage intelligence methods that might benefit U.S. adversaries. And I'm wondering why you thought it was important to ask him that.
Well, I think it is going to be natural and one of the first questions that many, many readers will ask to wonder, why are you doing this? And aren't you worried about damage to our security? There are real enemies out there. There are real foreign intelligence concerns that are of vital interest to the United States. And to the extent that disclosures would sort of damage the ability of U.S. intelligence to find out things it needs to find out, readers are going to wonder, you know, how could you do that? Who appointed you? Who elected you? Why is this okay? So I wanted him to have a chance to answer that in advance and in the very first stories.
And were you satisfied with his answer?
Look, he is a source of mine. He is the source of information that he provided to me. I thought he had a very well thought through answer. I wanted to put that answer before the public, and anyone can judge for himself or herself how much they agree or how much they disagree with it. If the Washington Post didn't think it was important to publish some substantial fraction of this stuff, we wouldn't be doing it. So we certainly agree that there are balances to be struck between perfect security and the ability for the public to make fundamental decisions about what its government is doing and what the rules should be. And we're looking for that balance. And to the extent that Snowden says, we've pushed the needle way too far in the direction of security, and in fact, some of this stuff isn't especially important for security and it is damaging to civil liberties and it is risky for the government to have this much power, I mean, I think it's clear that I and the Washington Post agree that those are questions at least worthy of debating, and you can't have that debate without information.
You've been publishing in the Washington Post. There was a Washington Post editorial July 1st that expressed editorial concern that Snowden is going to pass on some of these documents to the WikiLeaks people who will then just make it public without the kind of journalistic checks that you apply at the Washington Post. It also expressed concern that in exchange for asylum in Russia, Snowden would hand over secret American documents to Russia, thus exposing our secrets to a country that is sometimes, you know, very much opposed to what we're doing. So are you concerned about that? And is that something that you've talked to Snowden about?
Honestly, writing an editorial about the risk that Snowden or that implies that Snowden is about to or may already have handed over all his information to WikiLeaks or to the Russians is entirely without evidence. It is pure speculation. There is strong evidence that he does not intend to make the whole pile public. He could have done it on the first day. He could have done it months before I ever heard of him. As far as the speculation that the Chinese or Russian governments have obtained access to this information, that they have the whole pile, so all this alleged judiciousness by the journalist is pointless. That is not only speculative, but I think I have very strong evidence that it's not the case. I know how Snowden operates. I've disclosed some of it. I've not disclosed all of it. Just because he has unmasked himself doesn't mean that there are no confidences left in the relationship. He is exceptionally skilled at digital self-defense. In fact, one of his jobs while he was at the NSA and while he was employed by the CIA was to teach courses to U.S. national security officials about how to operate in a high-threat digital environment, even on untrusted hardware, essentially how you do secret business overseas without being surveilled by the other side. And I believe that he has rendered himself incapable of opening the archive while he's in Russia. That is to say, it's not only that he doesn't have the key anymore, it's that there's nothing for the key to open anymore, that he has rendered the encrypted information literally impossible to open with what he has in his possession. He has told a former senator in a letter that even under torture, he couldn't give the information to the Russians. And that's not a boast about his alleged ability to withstand torture. That is a statement of fact about his capabilities. He simply can't open it. And that means that the Russians can't get it.
You probably can't answer this. Are you still in touch with him?
I won't answer any questions about my contacts with Snowden, when I've had them, when I haven't, when I've received documents, when I haven't. I have a considerable number of confidential obligations in this source relationship, and Snowden is under pending criminal charges for conduct that includes his interaction with me, and I am not going to violate my journalistic obligation to protect that.
I get that. Do you feel like you're living in the middle of a spy thriller?
There are times when I wake up and say to myself, wow, this is crazy. I've never imagined a situation like this. Look, I've done national security investigative reporting for most of 2 decades. It was most of what I did at the Washington Post even before 9/11. It was all of what I did at the Post after 9/11. I continue to do it for Time magazine after I left the Post. I'm back now on a temporary contract. And look, I've taught a course at Princeton on national security secrecy. I've given lectures on it. I thought I was pretty well prepared on this subject, and I never imagined anything like this. And it's not just I've never had a story like this. I mean, really, no one has.
And how is it changing your life?
I was already accused by friends and colleagues of being on the paranoid side about source protection and notes protection. It has been a very long time since my notes were not encrypted, and I have learned to communicate with less and less of a digital trail over the years. And one of the distressing things that I've discovered is that there is no full refuge in technology. I can be as disciplined as possible. I can use every tool available to a lay person. And if a significant and well-resourced effort is made to penetrate that, I can't do a thing about it. I am now taking every precaution I know, even more than I ever have before, to protect the information I have that I don't intend to publish from hackers, from foreign governments. I mean, it resides on computers that never touch the internet and all kinds of other precautions that I won't describe in detail. And even so, it's now clear to me, having read through these files, that if the NSA wanted in, they'd find a way.
In part because of the revelations that you've published based on classified documents given to you by Edward Snowden, a lot of Americans are totally paranoid now that the government wants to read, you know, our emails and know about who we're calling. I'm interested in hearing your reflections on, you know, are we living in a Big Brother society where we're all being monitored?
You know, Big Brother is a very imperfect analogy. On the one hand, I see no evidence that there's anything but good intent to protect U.S. interests. I see no evidence that the government is assembling these tools in order to spy on political opponents or corruptly to serve some private interest or all the things that you worry about with the Big Brother analogy. On the other hand, it has accumulated powers that were beyond all imagination of George Orwell, that dwarf the surveillance capabilities of Orwell. And as it has done so, as it has made the whole world and the U.S. population more and more transparent, it has become more and more opaque about what it's doing. And so increasingly we are living behind one-way mirrors in which the government knows more and more about us. We know less and less about what the government is doing. That's the core reason why I believe these stories are important to tell. It is not the case that the government is collecting giant dossiers on every American, that it's browsing through those for any purposes other than what it considers to be national security purposes. But it is actually collecting records of every single phone call we make. It has given itself the means to collect comprehensively all the content of all communications in the United States. It is not doing all that it could do, but it has created a machine that is governed either by a slice of code or an internal regulation, either of which could change over time, and could at some point put in the hands of a future president, a future NSA director, powers that J. Edgar Hoover could not have dreamed of when he was abusing his powers at the FBI.
So that's one of your concerns, that someday somebody might come along who will abuse the powers and use this information inappropriately.
Look, anytime you accumulate vast powers in secret without effective checks outside the government itself, you know, that should cause students of history some concern.
Bart Gellin, thank you so much for talking with us. And, you know, be well, be safe.
Thank you very kindly for having me on again.
Bart Gellin speaking with Terry Gross last Wednesday. Gellin is a reporter for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. You can hear their full interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.